Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. If people who do not know what philosophy is or what it deals with attack it, that I would say is not too significant. And there are, of course, a great many such people. People to whom philosophy stands only for a few disconnected bromides or saying. They have no actual idea what the subject deals with, what the content of the topics are, what the structure of the organization. If people who do know something about what philosophy deals with, but who equate philosophy with the worst, most irrational ideas, attack it. I mean people who equate it with self-sacrifice, or communism, or skepticism, or linguistic analysis. If those people attack it, it also doesn't mean too much. But what about a different sort of person? I'm thinking of a person who knows in some terms what philosophy is. He knows its main branches, the issues it deals with, the overall structure of the subject. And let us say he has read Ayn Rand, and he's even sympathetic, in essence, to her viewpoint. He's an advocate of egoism, and he's an atheist, and he's an advocate of capitalism, and so forth. What about if people who fit that description attack philosophy? Yet, every so often, I hear arguments against philosophy from such people. And you must, unless you lead a very, very insulated existence, all have heard them, too, one way or another. I want to begin this course on understanding objectivism by giving you the three leading arguments, at least in my experience, against philosophy. Each of them claims that a happy man can't live according to a philosophy. Not any philosophy, whether objectivist or otherwise. They claim that every philosophy leads inevitably to serious problems for the person who holds it. Problems that far outweigh whatever value the philosophy brings. So that philosophy, in effect, is basically a source of harm. It's a grief to people. And the way to be happy, according to these arguments, is to kiss it goodbye and become a-philosophical or anti-philosophical. Now, these arguments have been raised to me across the years by people from many different viewpoints, including former objectivists. I say former because once they turn anti-philosophical, they usually abandon any philosophic affiliation. Now, some of these people, to be, as they say, upfront with you in advance, I do not like or respect. A number I don't. But some I do. Some are honest, even if, in my judgment, they're badly mistaken. They sincerely believe these arguments, and sometimes they're very torn about them. They don't know what to answer, how to answer, or whether there is an answer. I want to start by facing these issues head on. Now, these arguments are rarely formulated in detail the way I will present them to you. Usually, if only for the sake of politeness, people soften them a bit when they talk to me. They merely hint at them. But I'm not altogether obtuse, and I get the message. So I've taken the hints and organized them into three full-fledged arguments, which I want to present to you now sympathetically. I disagree with them, of course, but the answers come much later in the course. The point now is this. Can you answer these arguments? Do you feel that there is something, anything at all, to them? Can I get to you for even a minute with regard to any one of them? Does any of them have a trace of momentary plausibility to you? Now, for your own sake, I ask you to be fair. Don't simply dismiss them out of hand because you know that I'm going to slaughter them in the fullness of time. If you actually confront them honestly, you will find that it's very helpful as a self-diagnosis in regard to do you understand objectivism or not. So if you're ready, here I am, I have devoted my life to philosophy. I wrote a book about its inescapable importance. That's virtually the main message that I want to communicate in my life, and now I'm going to turn to assault the whole subject, including objectivism, as sympathetically as I can. And all my examples, by the way, are real, that is to say, they're taken from things actually said to me at least once. Number one, philosophy stifles individuality or the self. If you're taking notes, that would be the first thing worth taking. Philosophy stifles individuality or the self. And here's the argument. Philosophy, by definition, lays down a whole series of principles, telling people how to think, what to value. It says, in effect, here is the truth on every important issue, including issues of value. It lays down rules on what you should believe on every conceivable subject of significance, what you should think, do, feel. Well, by definition, the argument continues, this leaves little or even no room for individuality. For valuing or doing something that expresses your distinctive nature, your personal essence, your own self, the whole idea of philosophy, according to this argument, and this would be especially true of a philosophy which claims objectivity, the whole idea of a philosophy is to bring yourself under universal, impartial rules, rules that apply to all men at all times. The whole idea is to start to live in conformity with such rules, whether you like it or not. Well, what does that mean? According to this argument, then you have to repress your own personal self and start to behave like all the other advocates of that philosophy. You have to, in effect, become a robot or a follower, programmed to be just like all the other followers. That is the abstract statement of this first argument. You've heard this? I assume you have. Yes, I see you nodding. Now, let's give some examples. Lifestyles. Take a young man, for instance. He discovers objectivism. He accepts it as true. He loves the fountainhead, but he does not like skyscrapers. And there are such people. The sight of New York does not fill him with ecstasy. He may find it distasteful, noisy, dirty. He would much rather live on a ranch in California or on an island in the Caribbean. Well, the argument goes, if he gets into objectivism, he's soon going to absorb the message, skyscrapers represent the heroic in man, greatness, achievement, you know the whole thing. And his attitude, therefore, is anti-achievement, anti-man, etc. He is, in effect, indifferent to the good, and perhaps even an example of hatred of the good, and therefore he's wrong, he's low, he's bad. Now, what's the result, then? If this boy tries sincerely to be a good objectivist, he has to beat down this heretical feeling. He has to become a pro-skyscraper champion like everybody else, in the name of fidelity to his philosophy. But the price, therefore, is to cut himself off from his real feelings. In this case, the real lifestyle that he wants. He has to turn himself into what used to be called an other-directed or an unreal person, a mere follower. Or take a case from art. Beethoven is the obvious example here. A person hears and, say, is moved, deeply moved and stirred by Beethoven's symphonies. Then he discovers aesthetics. He discovers the objectivist aesthetics. He discovers that art is a sense of life issue, that it reveals your basic values, that your tastes reflect your metaphysical view of life. And then he hears that Ayn Rand personally disliked Beethoven, that she regarded him as malevolent universe. In other words, anti-values, anti-success, anti-man, the voice of doom. Well, it'll be the same pattern as with the skyscraper. Perhaps this person will consciously disavow Beethoven. Perhaps he'll just shy away from the whole issue and feel uncomfortable. But either way, his real personality, his taste, his preferences are not being expressed. Instead, he's pushing the attitude that he has been taught is right. I know a talented creative artist, a romantic artist, who believes that philosophy is incompatible with creativity, and it's the same type of argument. And this is a very sincere belief, because to be creative, this person feels, you have to be open to the new, to experiment. You have to give your subconscious absolute freedom in order to be able to come up with the groundbreaking, the untried, that which has so far never been conceived. But if you accept a philosophy, this artist feels, you get caged in with a whole set of aesthetic rules telling you, art must be this and it can't be that. This school is good, that one is based on determinism, etc., etc. The result is your subconscious is frozen in advance. If you take it seriously and really try to follow it, this person holds, you end up turning out inferior copies of whatever school or trend the philosophy happens to approve, instead of turning out your own individual works. Now, you can easily see how this sort of argument could be extended across the board. There's just countless examples I could give you, and will ultimately. You might say a person involved with objectivism might repress his real career choice in order to obey the objectivist idea of productivity. I'm sure you must have met a woman, if not more than one, who wants children, who does not want a professional career in industry or the professions like Dagny, and who feels she's inferior, she's guilty, she's violating the highest objectivist standards of productivity thereby. A person might repress his real love or friend in the name of having the right kind according to his philosophy, and so on and so on. All these people find themselves in the following position. If they pursue their own self, they feel guilt. If they repress it, they feel emptiness and frustration. So they're lost either way. And the conclusion they come to is the problem, the culprit, is the attempt to impose a philosophy, any philosophy, on a person's individuality. Now, by contrast to them, the man on the street seems to have a wonderful freedom because he is in this position. It is not true that everything is significant for him. It's not true that all of life is a federal case. He doesn't be proving something every minute by what he likes and dislikes. He can be and do whatever he wants, and there's no censor, no rules, no guilt. Now, ask yourself in your own mind, I won't ask for a show of hands here, but I'll try to read your faces. How many people here desire something? It can be in the realm of vacation, career, sexual style, I don't care. Something that you feel is perhaps not 100% objectivism as expressed in Ayn Rand's novel. And yet this is something that's important to you personally. If so, then you're going to ultimately have a problem. You will feel guilt, most likely. And then the pattern is you will repress it. And then in time you will resent the necessity to repress what matters to you. And then in time it is goodbye. I've seen this happen more than once, more than 10 times. Now, this is an important issue, and it's part of the real need for this course on understanding objectivism, to deal with and analyze this kind of problem with many actual real-life examples, so we can see what is and is not involved in living by a philosophy. Now, I want to present a psychological variation of this same argument. It's still number one. Don't worry, this is the longest, the others are short. And this argument goes as follows. If everybody was brought up as an objectivist, and they were in an objectivist world from the beginning, that would be fine, no problem. If they were taught only objectivist ideas, their whole psychology would presumably be based on them. Everything about the person would be consistent, integrated, it would be terrific. But in actual fact, they say life is not like that. People are brought up by irrational or at least inadequate parents, to say nothing of the environment, their neighbors, their teachers, the politicians, and all the rest of it. The result is by the time they discover objectivism, they're filled with contrary ideas and with neuroses. Most often, they don't even know their subconscious ideas. They don't know how they got them, when they were drilled into them, or how to get rid of them. Then they hear objectivism and their mind approves, and they're left with a tremendous clash. The legacy of their upbringing versus a rational philosophy. And they're caught between the two, forever trying to fight their childhood conclusions, doomed to a life of inner conflict. For instance, an example that I have heard a lot of times is like this. Take a person brought up in a horrendously bad, irrational home, who never forms a strong career value or a strong career passion. In effect, his life was such a jungle growing up that it took his full strength just to survive it. But he preserved his mind, he heard objectivism, comes into it, he agrees, and he hears now career is a crucial top value. And he would like to have a career passion, but he cannot find one in him. He searches. He can't find the kind of interest or values that he could start off with and build on. He's confronted, in effect, in this regard, with like a blank. Now, if he is a non-philosophical person, if he were, he would still, of course, suffer scars from his upbringing. Perhaps he never would be happy. But at least the argument goes he could at least struggle on. He could get something from other aspects of life. But if he's an objectivist, he has the constant mandate hanging over him, the image of Rourke, and therefore, by contrast, the constant self-criticism, self-condemnation, he's doomed to guilt for life. Now, this is the same basic argument, I think you can see. Common to all the examples is the clash between an individual's feelings and philosophy. In the first cases, the person believed the feeling was him. In some sense, he was proud of it. It gave him pleasure. And then he felt philosophy is putting him down, squelching him as an individual. In this career case, he sincerely doesn't like the feeling. He wishes he had a career passion. He doesn't regard it as his essence that he's proud of. He wishes to high heaven he could get rid of it. But he can't. So he's condemned to a life of cursing himself. But again, the idea is, what's common to them all is, myself, good or bad, like it or not, but me versus philosophy. Now, in regard to the psychological variant, you might say, well, there's an easy solution. If you have such deep problems, go find a psychotherapist. You might say, true, it's often hard to find your own basic premises, uproot them, reintegrate it, etc., but that's just what psychotherapy is for. So if you go and you work and you introspect and so on, in time, you'll resolve the clash, all will be well. You're nodding negatively, is that right? Well, perhaps the answer you get is the answer I get. What do you mean by in time? How long? And the person says, if psychology were so advanced and psychotherapy so efficient that we could in a reasonable time identify and eradicate all our bad premises, terrific. What's a reasonable time? 6 months? 6 years? There are a lot of people who would go for 6 years. They think that would be a great investment. But the argument says, in many cases, a person has problems of such a kind that with today's knowledge, they're actually insoluble. He can go to a therapist, a good, rational, efficient therapist. He can sincerely try. But because of the primitive level of psychological knowledge in the world today and the immense difficulties in changing a whole entrenched psychology, maybe 10 years would not be enough, 20, in order to change certain types of traits. So the person concludes, in effect, I'm condemned to fight an entire life of inner conflict. If I continue to hold before myself a theoretical ideal of what I should be. But on the other hand, what if I say, I've got to be realistic. I can't change this attitude. I've tried, but it's immovable. That's how I'm going to be till I die. So rather than perpetual conflict, I say to hell with philosophy. I'm simply not built for it. I'm a certain way. Call it sick or neurotic or warped, whatever you want, but I can't do anything about it, and I resign. So in one variant here, the person says, this is me, and I want to be this way, and philosophy stamps me down. And the other says, this is me, and I don't want to be this way, but I have no choice, I have to, and again, philosophy stamps me down. So in either case, there's constant inner conflict. That is the argument, philosophy versus the individual, or philosophy versus the self. Number two. This is briefer. Philosophy causes a life of outer conflict or cultural alienation. Philosophy causes a life of outer conflict or cultural alienation. This is like philosophy versus the world. And here is the abstract argument. Philosophy, by definition, lays down a set of rules and principles by which you should evaluate, by which you should judge the things around you. Other people, government practices, religions, everything. A person with a definite philosophy, therefore, is always judgmental. He's always saying, this is right, true, good, or that is wrong, false, bad. The world around you, however, rarely shares your philosophy. Now, sometimes, we concede, a person may be in harmony with his environment. For instance, a very religious man in the height of the Middle Ages. So this argument wouldn't apply to him. But usually the argument goes, the philosophically consistent person is at variance with the world. And this is true. Because he is consistent, the world is contradictory. He has a thought-out definite system, the world is eclectic. He has high standards, the world is pragmatic or expedient. He is independent, and most people by definition are conventional, and so on. So the philosophical person is in the position of, in effect, constantly condemning what he sees around him, constantly running the world down as contrary to his standards, his principles, his values. Most cultures, after all, certainly today's, is a grab bag, a mixture of all kinds of elements, and most people are not very consistent. And the result is there will be a tremendous amount to criticize from the point of view of any philosophy. Now the argument goes on. This is particularly true of objectivism. Here is a revolutionary philosophy. It attacks wholesale the basic principles of the last 2,500 years. It's confronting a society which reflects in countless ways, large and small, the exact opposite ideas. The result is a sincere objectivist, it's claimed, has to live a life of cultural alienation. He has to feel constantly like an outsider, or a victim or an outcast facing a corrupt, hostile world. He's in effect a loner trapped among hordes of the irrational, the unjust. And on top of that, he can't simply remain silent because he knows the principle that you mustn't sanction evil. You have to condemn it in order to be just. So his whole life becomes a protracted battle, a constant conflict with the people around him. His emotional feel of life as a result is loneliness, malevolence, trouble, pessimism. If he meets someone at a party, I've heard, he can't, like an ordinary person, just chat over a drink, relax, enjoy it. Whatever he talks about soon generates some sort of philosophic issue because philosophy is everywhere. And the next thing you know, he's in a fight over religion or politics or whatever. Even if he keeps quiet at the party, he's on edge, he's tense. He doesn't know what the next statement by some person or group is going to be, when or what they're going to say that he'll have to jump in and condemn in order to be true to his principles. So leaving aside a few soulmates as isolated and in despair as he, his social life is continual anxiety, trouble, unpleasantness. If he goes to a movie, say he goes to see E.T. He can't simply settle back and enjoy it like everybody else. Because since he's philosophical, he has to analyze it. He has to see it as a cultural symbol. And sure enough, in today's world, he's going to find all kinds of errors or evils in just about everything, which will end up putting the damper on or entirely destroying his enjoyment. E.T., for instance, is definitely anti-adult. It's anti-science. I've heard a number of people say, therefore, it's an evil, irrational movie. I can't resist saying I love that movie. Well, that's for later. If an objectivist goes to class at college, I've heard, he either has to feel fear of what his professors are going to say, because he knows he's going to have to disagree and therefore be subject to the class's ridicule, or at minimum, he's going to be filled with disgust, contempt, revulsion. Even if he goes to a party of objectivists, so I've been told, he cannot have a good time because he has to spend the evening on philosophy, on big issues. Everything has to be intellectual, so he understands. You can't be mindless, and they end up discussing how awful the world is. And if somebody there does want just to relax, forget his troubles for the night, he stands a good chance of being accused of being evasive, anti-intellectual, etc. Now, the conclusion of this argument is, it is simply not worth living. If life is nothing but struggle, tension, condemnation, loneliness, and gloom, what's the solution? Get rid of the root of it all, this judgmental attitude, this constant concern with right or wrong, true or false. Get rid of philosophy and then simply enjoy yourself. Like the man on the street, again the symbol of a blissful existence. He just takes the world as it is. If he likes a movie, it would never occur to him to analyze it. If he meets a guy at a party, he couldn't care less what he thinks. He accepts the rule, never argue about religion or politics. He's free. He's cheerful. He has no sense of being a cornered victim in a malevolent world. How does he do it? He's not enslaved by a philosophy. Now, this is another crucial topic to be discussed with the real life examples and many more. So, according to one argument, it's the self versus philosophy, the inner world versus philosophy. And according to the second, the outer world versus philosophy. So it's a twofold torture chain. And that brings us to the last one, the briefest, but it sort of puts the capper on the first two. Why go through all this torture for nothing? Now you say, why for nothing? Because this argument claims philosophy is basically useless. Number three, philosophy is basically useless. Now the standard version of this, you know. Who needs philosophy? It's all empty talk, etc. But the version I have in mind is more sophisticated. This is the version I've heard. True, philosophy is important when you're young or when you first discover it. It helps set your basic direction. You're swamped by so many possibilities and choices at that point. And you have no firm ideas as to what to choose or how. You're confronted with a mass of possible careers and religions and friends and lifestyles. You're just drowning in possibilities. And you need a guide. So philosophy is really important or helpful at this stage. It kind of orients you to life. But, the argument goes on, at a certain point, your basic direction has been established. For example, if you come to objectivism, you pretty soon give up religion, you resign from the Socialist Party, you reject a progressive education for your children, you pick out an appropriate career and a hard-working lifestyle, you choose a certain appropriate friends, etc. At this point, the argument asks, what more do you get out of philosophy? Now, of course, people concede, if you're an intellectual, a writer, a lecturer, and so on, then you might need philosophy, because you're actively dealing with its issues all the time. But what if you're not an intellectual? Suppose you're a mother, or a businessman, or a lawyer, or a sculptor. In other words, you're a person. I mean, as against, you know, an intellectual. All your basic decisions in life are made. So what do you do with philosophy then? What do you get from it? Your career is set, and most of your time is spent pursuing it. And philosophy is irrelevant to you there. You try cases, or treat patients, or sell bread, etc., without need of any further philosophy. Your daily activities are set, your friends, your routines, your lifestyle, and you're overwhelmed with the demands and concretes of daily existence. Who has time for philosophy and what for? And the way I've sometimes heard this point, what does being an objectivist consist of? What do you do with objectivism other than attend lectures by Peacock? Now, I was discussing this argument recently with Peter Schwartz, and he made the very perceptive comment that this argument is like deism in religion. You know that in religion, there are like three camps. There's the true believers who hold that God is all-powerful and determine everything. Then there are the deists who say, no, God is necessary to start the universe off, but after that, he retires from the scene and simply watches disinterestedly with no power to interfere. And then come the atheists who say, if we can get along without God, for all those millennia, we can get along without him at the very beginning too. A very valid development. In natural law, without God altogether is the only consistent alternative. In other words, deism was merely a stage in the atrophy of religion. The logical finale was atheism. Well, you see, I think, the parallel here. The view that philosophy is necessary to start us off in a certain direction, but thereafter is useless in life, is like the deism of this issue, and it leads in logic to the same result, namely that philosophy is dispensable even at the beginning, because there is then some other way of reaching conclusions or making decisions in life, some non-philosophical way. And if that can work okay for the last 40 or 50 years of your life, it can work for all of your life in principle just as well. So this argument, despite its appearance of making concessions to philosophy, really amounts to an attack on the usefulness of philosophy as such, at any point. The whole thing comes down to the question, if I intend to be a decent, hard-working person, what on earth do I need philosophy for in my daily life? Now that states the three arguments in essence. Dare I ask, if I don't put you on the spot to say anything, and if you would give me an honest answer, how many find, if I don't hold it against you, how many find at least a momentary plausibility in some aspect of at least one of these arguments? Would you raise your hand? Well, that's terrific. For the record, the vast majority raised their hands. I worked very hard to induce that result. Now, I would like specifically to make you give you a homework assignment here. And that is your answer to the last one in particular, number three. We're going to cover all of them, but I'm especially interested in your answer, if you have one, to number three. That is the actual role, if any, of objectivism in daily life. Not monumental, once-in-a-lifetime, life-shaping decisions. If you have anything to say on that, I would very much appreciate getting a written note from you. You don't have to sign it, because I'd like to deal with that, and I'd like to get your thinking on that point. Now, what is the common denominator of all these arguments? All three. The separation of philosophy from life. The dichotomy of philosophy versus life. Philosophy is regarded as either useless in living, removed from life, that's the third argument, or a positive harm and hindrance to living. So that there's life and there's philosophy and you have to choose. Now you must know that this viewpoint is extremely widespread today. It is not confined to one-time objectivists, although I focused on that for our purposes. The whole culture is saturated with anti-philosophical ideas. We could divide people into various categories on this basis, and you'd see how tremendously common the viewpoint is. In one category, obviously, would be the explicit skeptics about philosophy. Those who openly scorn it as a waste of time, hot air, no cash value. The type of person for whom any term descriptive of thought as such means removed from life. For instance, they say it's abstract, and to them abstract means nothing to do with concrete reality. It's academic or scholastic, and to them what goes on in academies or schools by definition has nothing to do with reality. It's, quote, theoretical, and of course therefore has nothing to do with practice, etc. In another category would be those who profess certain philosophic ideas and even respect them in a way, but who are careful to keep them as a side issue in their lives without any central ruling influence. This is what Ayn Rand called the church on Sundays attitude. One day a week or a month, I pay homage to my ideas, but the rest of the time in self-preservation, I forget about them and get on with the business of living. And you see, this is only a variant of the outright skeptic, because they both agree on the actual irrelevance of philosophy to life. The skeptic merely dispenses with the need of a weekly ritual. And lastly, just to complete the survey, there's another type of person. Those who do take ideas seriously and really try to live by them day and night. And where do the examples in quantity come from of this type? Only two sources that I know of. Religions and totalitarian movements. Nuns who retire from the world, renounce sex, take a vow of poverty, never speak, etc. They live by what they preach all the time, or at least enough of it so they're allowed to rest off. Or Nazis and communists who give up everything, body and soul, to the party. In other words, this third category embraces fanatics who sacrifice their life to their philosophy. They too, you see, agree that it's your life or your philosophy. And then they merely give up their life for philosophy. But the basic issue is still the same, life or philosophy. Everybody agrees, therefore, almost everybody, that philosophy is removed from life. And the arguments I began with are only a kind of in-group version of this same basic attitude. And yet, we know, objectivists know, they should know, that something is wrong with all of this. Philosophy is not self-sacrifice, according to objectivism. It's the means, the indispensable means, of achieving self-interest, prosperity, the enjoyment of life. So we know or should that philosophy is not detached from life, that it's not an impediment to living but a vital necessity. In other words, I'm turning now to the opposite viewpoint, the objectivist viewpoint. If you want it in Hegelian terms, we finished the thesis. And now the antithesis, the crucial importance of philosophy in human life. Now, I'm not yet answering the arguments I gave you. I'm merely reminding you of the exact opposite attitude to philosophy. That philosophy is the exact reverse of those three arguments. According to objectivism, philosophy is essential to creating a self, to dealing with the world, to managing at all in daily life. Now, this is a graduate course. This course presupposes familiarity with Ayn Rand's works, with my lectures, etc. So I'm going to be very brief on this part, because I want to cover new material in this course and not the same stuff again. So this is in the nature of a reminder. And if, as is true of a few people here, you are here for the very first time, if you don't know anything about objectivism, this is the wrong lecture to be at. Because I'm taking for granted a context that will leave you utterly baffled. So good luck and get what you can. But this is definitely aimed at an audience that already has an extensive knowledge of objectivism. Therefore, to you, I merely remind you, what is philosophy? It's a science of fundamental ideas, the science that tells you the nature of the world, of man, of man's means of knowledge, and on that basis offers a code of values to guide his choices, actions, products, institutions. Do we need it? Well, you've all read, I'm sure, philosophy. Who needs it? You know that he needs it. Man needs philosophy by his essential nature. His mind needs the conclusions of philosophy to function at all. He has to know what is reality and can he count on it. What is knowledge and how is it obtained? What is the good and how should it be pursued? Does philosophy have any actual role in life? Well, you must have read the ominous parallels if you're paying the price of this course. I claim there, and I believe I've proved, that philosophy is the factor ultimately moving everyone and everything. That it's inescapable even by people who denounce it. That it's responsible for the trends in economics, art, politics, literature, education, youth movements, movies, people's psychology, you name it. What do you get out of holding a definite philosophy? Well, when I was a college student, they used to say to freshmen, and they used to say this about philosophy in general, to motivate them. And it applies more to objectivism in as much as it's a rational philosophy. They used to tell us when I was a freshman, and it was very persuasive. From philosophy, you get a sense of certainty as against agonizing doubt. You get a basic self-confidence, a sense of intellectual control, of control over your own mind and its method of thinking. You gain a fundamental understanding of the world, of why things are as they are, what can be changed, what can't. And you get a sense of purpose, of priorities, of values, of what's important as against what's trivial, what counts in life, where you're going, what you need to know and do to be happy. That was the kind of speech that they used to give to freshmen in my day. And it's all true. Philosophy does all this and much more. I'm not going to detail it, because you must be familiar with the pro-philosophic side of the argument. The man on the street whom the anti-philosophic arguments regard as blissfully free of philosophy, is actually, assuming he really is unphilosophical, is actually harmed by that fact. Because however decent and nice he is, to him, the world is basically a mystery, especially today. He cannot fathom what is going on. And if he is decent, to that very extent, he can make no sense of the injustices he sees. He's not even sure that they are injustices or what injustice is. He doesn't know. He has no answers. He doesn't even have any clear questions. He has no method to begin to untangle it all. So he just pulls his horns in and scrapes by. He may be productive, but he has no sense of control. He can't question or challenge in any serious way. And as you know, quite without his knowledge or consent, he's being led systematically, step by step, to disaster. That's a brief pro-philosophy pitch, just to counterbalance a bit. So we can say this. On the one hand, philosophy is critically important. It's a life-giving value, especially objectivism. But on the other hand, there are all these arguments that philosophy is really a bane and not a blessing. So it's like A and non-A. What is the resolution? Now, I'm not going to answer the three arguments I started with in this lecture. Each of them is complex. It's a mixture of several elements. Each of them has some valid points. They point to some real problems involved in living, albeit misapplied with the wrong conclusion. Each has many confusions that need painstaking straightening out. And they contain some outright, very concrete errors about objectivism. Objectivism does not, for instance, say that you have to like skyscrapers or that you have to come to lectures. But for detailed answers, you have to await the last half of this course. The argument about the uselessness of philosophy, we're covering in Lecture 9. Philosophy versus the self is 10 and part of 11. Philosophy versus the world is the part of 11 and 12. So you've got a long time to wait. But this is a course, not a self-contained lecture. And so we have to lay a whole groundwork first. What I want to do now is simply state in general terms the basic error common to all three of these arguments, the basic cause of people raising them, whatever else is involved. More than this is involved, but this is the basic cause. Are you ready for this? I would say the cause of the problems mentioned in all these arguments is not philosophy or objectivism, but philosophy or objectivism wrongly understood. And I don't mean here specific concrete errors. I mean wrongly understood in a fundamental, all-embracing way. Put it another way. The cause is objectivism improperly digested or assimilated. Or put it still another way, the same point. The cause is objectivism held as a series of abstractions not tied to reality. Objectivism held as a series of abstractions untied to reality. If a person did understand objectivism, and I'm using the word understanding, which is now the title of the course here, in a specific way, I mean grasping it in its actual relation to reality, not as floating generalities, I would say such a person, whatever problems he has, would not raise the arguments I mentioned. And I want now to develop this theme. Nobody, certainly nobody sane and honest, can say, let's get rid of reality. It's too much trouble. It interferes with my self-expression, or it causes grief in dealing with other people, or it's useless in daily life. Reality, by definition, is all there is. It's what we live in and deal with every moment. And it's what we have to conform to if we are to survive and function at all, let alone prosper. Now, on the perceptual level, the level of sensory perception, there's no argument about this. If you started to walk into the path of a speeding truck, and someone screamed out to you, "Watch out for the truck," no one, apart from a deliberate suicide, would dream of answering the following. "Don't try to impose rules on me. I want to express myself." Or, "I don't have views on trucks because I don't want to argue all the time. And people have so many different ideas about trucks." Or, "I've already seen all the trucks I need to in my life when I was young. Looking is a waste of time for me now. I'm too busy." Now, that's the analog of the three arguments on the perceptual level. Now, on that level, reality confronts us immediately, concretely, inescapably. It is not a matter of debate. The point is, this does not happen on the conceptual level. The level of ideas, abstractions, thought. On that level, a gap is possible. An idea sincerely held, mind you, but utterly unconnected to the world. And that is what makes possible a disdain of ideas. If ideas, and I mean here abstract philosophical ideas, were held by people with the same immediacy, the same reality, the same relation to actual perceptual concretes as the way we see trucks, none of the anti-philosophical line could arise, because it would be immediately obvious that it was an anti-reality line. If a person saw his philosophy in every concrete, and I mean see it, really see it, the way he now sees trucks, then no problems of the kind mentioned could arise. The person might still have problems with himself or with people, but he wouldn't have problems with philosophy. He wouldn't think the solution is to abandon philosophy. The issue, therefore, is that many people do not see their philosophy that way. They hold it some other way. I want to say parenthetically, but emphatically, this is not a moral judgment. I'm including a lot of honest, well-meaning, perfectly sincere people in this statement. This is not restricted to some corrupt slob. If it were, I wouldn't give a course. Let me put the exact same point, just in a different terminology, because it illuminated another aspect. You know, the essence of being in favor of reason is proving your ideas, validating them, as against going by faith or blindly following authority. Well, what does proving an idea consist of? It is not, N-O-T. Proof is not some formalized, ritualized deduction that would satisfy a pack of desiccated scholars somewhere. It is not, I repeat, it is not some tricky, convoluted rigmarole designed to outwit dishonest adversaries. Proof is a very simple thing, and it is utterly non-social. It is the method of seeing firsthand that your ideas come from reality, that they actually reflect or correspond to facts of reality. That's all. Proof is really nothing but taking an abstract idea and endowing it with the vividness, the immediacy, the compelling quality of the percept of the truck that we talked about. So if you've really proved an idea, it should stand in your mind like that truck, as a fact which is there, real, perceivable, unanswerable, absolute. Now, of course, this is easy to say, but hard to do. The question is, how do you achieve this state? How do you get your ideas, particularly philosophic ideas, into this kind of relation to reality? How do you take broad abstractions and make them in your mind seem like obvious transcripts of reality, so immediate that to you they are like percepts with all that clarity and compelling power? That is the question. And that's what I mean when I say we have to learn to understand philosophic ideas, and specifically objectivism. I mean, grasp their relation to reality. Now, in a way, this problem exists for all abstractions, from any area or subject matter, whether philosophy or not. You know from the objectivist epistemology that abstractions are symbols, shorthand symbols. They're integrations of concretes to enable us to deal with countless instances by a single word, held in a single frame of consciousness. And as such, abstractions, by their nature, are a step removed from reality. And you know, there's a whole series of levels that get farther and farther removed. There's actual trucks that you can point to. Then there's the concept truck, which is a unit in your mind which you have to think what does it stand for to connect it to reality. And then there's vehicle, which is still broader, includes trucks and cars and boats, etc., and another step removed, and so on, so on, so. And you know, there's all sorts of devices and methods that are inherent in concepts and necessary to keep them connected to reality, such as giving examples, for instance, offering definitions, for instance, and a lot more. So the problem of understanding abstractions, keeping them tied to reality, exists on all abstractions. But the point I want to make now is it is hardest and worst in regard to philosophy. The problem is worst in regard to philosophy. Who can say why in one sentence? Yes. Did you point that at him? He says, I'm not supposed to repeat, but here I'm repeating. Correct, he said correctly. Philosophy deals with the broadest abstractions. It's the most universal. You could look at it this way. Philosophy is at once the easiest and the hardest subject there is. That's it. Yeah. That's class participation till after the break. It's the hardest and easiest subject that there is for the same reason. But there's two different angles on that reason. And the reason is it's the most universal. Therefore, in one way, it's the easiest. You don't need any specialized knowledge. It deals only with issues available at all times, in all places, to all professions. To engage in philosophy, you don't need to know science, engineering, medicine, no specialized knowledge. You just have to look at the world and grasp what's available in every age to every man. And in that way, it's the easiest. But in another sense, it's the hardest. Because it is tremendously abstract. Here, your symbols, your words, are covering not just trucks, but existence, the totality. Not just a toothache, say, but consciousness. Not just going to a movie, but freedom or happiness or whatever. These types of concepts, existence, consciousness, freedom, etc., have so many concretes of such a bewildering variety in so many different contexts and applications. And yet in philosophy, somehow, we have to hold these wealth of concretes together, disregard all these concrete differences, and move in a continual realm of tremendous abstraction. And most people simply cannot do it. In other words, they can grasp the ideas, but only by cutting loose from reality. Only by forgetting about trucks, toothaches, movies, etc., and functioning in a world made only of words, of abstractions. In other words, they don't know how to keep this level of abstraction connected to daily life, to actual reality, the reality they live in, work with, perceive. So for them, whatever their intentions, philosophy ends up like church on Sunday. It's something dissociated from life. It's a special occasional ritual. They may be sincere, but they can't keep it real. That's what it comes down to. Now you see here the deeper reason, an epistemological reason, why philosophy is so widely scorned. It's not only because of the wrong ideas of philosophy that people have. It's the very nature of abstraction, of the difficulty that abstractions present to us. And that difficulty comes out worst in regard to philosophy. Now, to carry this a step further, if philosophy is the easiest yet the hardest subject, the same goes in spades for objectivism. I could make a case that it's the easiest of all philosophies to assimilate and the hardest. Why the easiest? Because it's true. It's actually based on reality. That makes it much easier to grasp than fantasies about a supernatural dimension and the beauty of self-immolation for the collective unconscious. On the other hand, precisely because it does throw out fantasies, it's of no use at all if it's held in a cut-off-from-reality fashion. A false philosophy, to an extent, must be divorced from reality. And to that extent, it is not so difficult to hold. You don't have to work to see its relation to reality. It has no relation to reality. It's like a fairy tale, and you can usually follow it without much work or difficulty, however weird it gets. There's no problem struggling to tie it into reality because the whole system says, in effect, this is above reality. This is another dimension you shouldn't think, have faith, believe, etc. But in objectivism, by contrast, the whole thing about it, in every principle and detail, the whole thing is the tie to reality, to the concretes around us. Precisely because it's true, there's a tremendous amount of work involved in holding it, in keeping it connected to reality. And this is a giant task that is not imposed by a false philosophy. If you forget reality while reading Kant, that's not a problem. It can be very helpful. But if you forget reality in regard to objectivism, it becomes ludicrous and the whole thing is pointless. However, this is not easy to do, that is, to keep reality. It is not obvious how to keep a philosophy tied to reality. It is not obvious at all. I would say, in fact, it's a very difficult and very rare feat. Good intentions and sincerity are not enough for this. You need a definite method of dealing with ideas, a method which is not self-evident. I'm going to continue this point on the need for a method after a short break. Thank you. Okay, let us pick up where we were before. I was saying that we need a method of grasping or understanding ideas. And I want to elaborate that point. I have watched objectivists for many years try to assimilate the ideas of objectivism, starting, I may say, with myself and my own struggles. In other words, I've watched them try to grasp the proof, the tie to reality, in that truck-like fashion, let's continue to call it that. That's not truck driver, that's a different point. I've seen well-meaning, educated students, intelligent, motivated, hard-working. I've seen them read all the materials, take courses in objectivism, and yet they cannot really do it. In other words, they cannot digest the material. They can't do it with their eyes steadily on reality. However they try and wrestle with the material, it does not gel in their minds into a lucid, unanswerable perception of reality. They end up seeing it, in effect, as though through a glass darkly, or in a kind of fog. Now, I hasten to add that I myself went through a long period in this state. And by a long period, I mean, well, at least 15 years. And that was my field, full time. Now, at first, I thought everyone else understood but me, and that the problem was my own deficiencies. But eventually I saw the same problem and pattern repeated on person after person. And I came to conclude that a special method is necessary to grasp philosophy, to keep it reality-oriented. A method with many aspects and specific steps calculated to add up in keeping ideas real. And I worked, I would say, for a number of years off and on defining this method. Most recently, we held a seminar with several very advanced objectivists, that is, they've been in it a long, long time, exploring our mutual mental processes, the methods we used, the problems in understanding the ideas, what was really clear to them, what was not, how to make it better. And that is actually how this course arose and what it's really all about. It's in effect tips from a veteran, I'm certainly old enough to qualify for that name, on how to really understand objectivism. But what you have to see clearly at the outset is why a special method is necessary. Many people have the idea that they can read a book on philosophy or objectivism. Now we mean here, they're reading it in focus, they're sincere, they follow carefully. But they think that if they do that, and then at the end say, well, this makes sense, I agree, that constitutes understanding. It does not. That's not true. Reading is not enough. The same is true of lectures. You can listen to someone else, the most wonderful lecturer in history, and you can be focused, sincere, honest. But that does not yield understanding in the sense we're talking about. Now, I'm not downplaying reading or listening. That's obviously important. It's vital. It's the first step in learning a new philosophy. But the point is, it's only the first step. There's a whole process that has to come after that if you are to reach the state of seeing, knowing, really grasping. There's a whole series of intervening steps required to bridge the gap. And I gave myself the assignment to try to identify what were the major steps that it had to intervene, at least as well as I could. Now, I do not have the last word on this question, but I think I have some words. In other words, the question I set was this. Assuming that a person listens to a philosophy lecture or a book completely attentively, what else then, afterwards, has to go on in his mind in order for the ideas to emerge at the end as real knowledge that he possesses? And my answer is essentially offered in this course. Without these steps, I believe, the best book or lecture simply fades away in your mind. And it has to, by the very nature of things. Because the essence of these intermediate steps is how to make the material an actual part of your thinking, of your perception of reality. If you don't know the steps and you don't perform them, then the material never becomes a part of you. It becomes merely, in effect, the memory of somebody else's words. And however eloquent they are, that is necessarily a peripheral issue in your life. It has to fade away in time. It has to remain a side issue because it has no real functioning reality in your mind. So reading and listening is not enough. Now something else is not enough. People often confuse understanding an idea with summarizing it. They confuse understanding with summarizing. Write that down if you're taking notes. It is not enough to be able to give a summary, even a good, accurate summary. A summary does not necessarily signify understanding in the sense we're using it. In other words, that reality based like the perception of the truck. It is possible to give a very clear, accurate summary of an idea, which is nevertheless floating and detached from reality. That is possible. That is common. Take the virtue of honesty. That's a topic we're going to be covering later in the course. Now, in the seminar that I mentioned, a very intelligent woman, whom I like and greatly admire, I stress this, what I'm about to say is not a criticism of her mind or her character, she's here tonight. But she gave a good example, I think, of this point. She volunteered to present her understanding of the virtue of honesty. In other words, of why you should be honest in life. She proceeded to give the following kind of statement. I'm abbreviating, but this is the essence of it for purposes of our discussion right here. She said, in effect, like this. If life is the standard of value, then the top virtue has to be rationality, exercising your mind. And rationality means grasping the facts of reality that you deal with. Honesty has to be a part of this because it tells you not to evade reality or pretend. Therefore, you should be honest. Now, that is about, I think, how the virtue of honesty stands in the minds of many objectivists. And that's assuming even that they remember the proof up to that point. In other words, the connection to rationality and life as the standard, etc. This is, in effect, what I just said is the sum of their grasp of the issue. Now, I'm not putting down summaries. I spent a lot of time giving summaries. Half of lectures are summaries. And it's certainly okay as a summary. But the point is, if that is what you have in your mind in regard to honesty, that is not the same as understanding. Not in the way we're talking about. That statement that I gave is simply a series of very broad abstractions with no indication of the tie to actual facts. The summary mentioned, grasping reality. What does it mean to grasp the facts of reality? Now, when you hear that, does your mind flood with examples? Or does it stall, freeze, go blank at the question? What does it mean to evade? Now, I'm not here asking for some formal definition. But what concrete does the terms actually stand for? Why, for example, does a liar have to evade? Can't he know the truth for himself, but merely lie to others? So it's not enough to just say, don't evade. Why does life require complete honesty? Why can't you be honest most of the time? But occasionally lie. That doesn't mean you're evading all of reality. Can't you still live and function and be happy? Etc., etc., etc. In other words, there is a tremendous gap between that brief abstract summary statement and a real, concrete, overwhelming understanding of the virtue of honesty. Now, in the seminar, we spent what? I think maybe 5 hours on this one virtue. And we didn't repeat ourselves either. And we're going to be trying to cover that in lecture 3 in this course. The summary, in short, is merely like a headline over a tremendous newspaper article. Now, if you know the article, it's fine to be able to state the headline. But if all you know is the summary, it doesn't do you any good. So we need a method of processing abstractions, and the method is not obvious. Now, just in case you think you already have anticipated me entirely, well, maybe you have. I mean, I don't have a patent on this. But the method is not merely giving definitions to your terms. This is a topic that I think has been overdone. Sometimes, of course, you need definitions. But as we'll see, sometimes, get this, definitions can be positively harmful to your mental process. Did you get that one? Now, for details, wait till next week. Nor does the method consist merely of concretizing or giving examples. That's just the tip of the iceberg. Now, these are all topics for the next weeks as we develop the method. The point is that the process of digesting ideas is not self-evident and has to be learned as a deliberate assignment. No human skill is automatic. They all have to be learned, whether you're talking about walking, or typing, or making love, or cooking. It doesn't make any difference. There are no innate ideas. If you want, you can compare learning philosophy, learning to understand it, with learning cooking. Now, nobody would think that you could read a cookbook or attend a course, even one with exciting demonstrations. Listen intently and then emerge knowing how to cook. You could come out with a summary, but you would not be an accomplished cook. Now, of course, I'm not putting down lectures on cooking. I've gone to them. They're very interesting, and you can grasp a great deal this way. That's the only way, basically, in some form of reading or lecturing, to take in all the earlier thought and knowledge on the subject. But if this is all that you do, you read or listen, it's soon going to fade. You're going to forget your lectures just as if it had never taken place. What do you have to do? Well, in this example, you have to cook. You have to enter a kitchen. You have to make things. You have to make the theory that you learned abstractly a part of you. You have to see it in connection with the reality around you. And in that case, your kitchen is the reality. For instance, you may have heard a lecture on saucepans, on all the types and what you should use on what kind of souffle and so on. Now you come into reality, your kitchen, and you look at your own. And you have to decide, can I make this recipe with this pan or not? What was the reason that you needed X size, etc., and so on? You have to work it out and try. You have to connect your theoretical knowledge to your concrete kitchen. You may have had a whole lecture on a food processor, and you were told to press the button to start it, but now you look at it, and one way is pulse and the other is steady. Which way do you press it? There are millions and millions of questions. In order to pass from the generalized knowledge of even a brilliant lecture on cooking to actual reality-connected knowledge of an accomplished cook. Now, philosophy is the same, only more so, because the abstractions are so what? You need to actually philosophize in order to make the material part of it. You have to enter the philosophical kitchen and work with the material from the books and the lectures. Now, we can drop the analogy and just say it straight. The real goal has to be to learn to derive your philosophy from reality as though you were the first creator of it. In other words, having heard the lectures or read the books, you have to then forget. You have to forget all summaries, all lecture notes, and go back to reality and learn to grasp the philosophic idea from what you directly perceive, what you know about yourself. Now, obviously, this is how Ayn Rand had to get objectivism. She didn't get it from reading Atlas, nor from attending my lectures. To her, it was like seeing the truck was the result of her perception of reality, obviously not on just one day. Now, there is no substitute for this. Her summary in her works is the beginning of the quest. It's like a map or a traffic guide, but that's all. You still have to travel the same route. Of course, the map makes it a lot easier, but you still have to take the journey. Now, there are many, many complexities involved in this journey. To give you just a sort of advance and anticipated idea, don't take notes because we cover all this in an organized way. How do you get philosophy from reality directly without the intermediaries of other people's lectures and books? Well, take one obvious difficulty. Philosophy, you know, is hierarchical. It's a whole structure, one idea resting on another, etc. So most of it seemingly can't be gotten from reality directly. You need to have a whole fund of philosophy already established to pave the way for whatever you're studying. So how do you grasp that whole fund to begin with, and then how do you hold it in your mind to get to the next idea without having that fund of abstraction swamp you, overcome you, detach you from reality? That's a big problem. We need a method of being able to condense all of the background of a given issue into a simple unit which is still based on reality, so that you can hold it all easily, yet without drowning in ideas at the expense of reality. That's a technique that has to be learned. Now you say, as another example of the problem here, you have to concretize, sure. But when? And how? Sometimes concretization is just the wrong thing. Can you guess why? If you overdo it, if you give too many concretes, what sets in? Who can guess? I heard the word somewhere. The crow, epistemology. You're trying to grasp something and it's delicate and complicated. I'm assuming you know by the crow epistemology we mean you can only hold so many units in your mind at a given moment. The mind is limited in what it can absorb. If you give it too many units, it just goes blank and loses everything. That's what we're summarizing crow epistemology. So if you give it too many concretes, you just obliterate your understanding. Of course, if you give it too few, it's vague, it's empty, it's unreal. Well, how much is too much? I've indicated as another point, you need to know when to rely on definitions and when to say, no, this is not the place for a definition. Another point you need to know, when to ignore polemics. In other words, all criticism from other people. And just follow a progression in the privacy of your own mind. And on the other hand, when it's important to turn around and play devil's advocate, when there's really something you have to face an answer, and so on and so on. It's a whole complex process, and Ayn Rand herself called this process chewing, on the obvious analogy. Chewing, she called it. And the way she thought of it was like this. First, you hear or think of an idea. That's like taking a bite of food into your mouth. But then comes the chewing, the breaking it down, ripping it into its elements, establishing its reality tie in detail. And the result, of course, is digestion. You can assimilate it. Your system can use it. That's the purpose of the first half of the course. In effect, it's the theory and practice of chewing ideas, and thereby making them digestible. Without this, your ideas will be generalized, unconvincing, and ultimately unimportant to you. With it, your idea should be like 2 and 2 is 4, or the sky is blue, lucid, convincing, reality-based. Now, of course, one reason why people don't know the method of chewing is that it's not taught. It needs to be discovered. It needs to be communicated as a separate skill. We're going to do something on that in lectures 2 to 6. And now I want to go to the last major topic for this evening. There's a second reason that people do not know this skill of chewing or digesting ideas. There's a particular philosophic error, very widespread, even among objectivists, even among good, sincere objectivists. Very widespread error which stops people from grasping the right method. And that is really the subject of the entire second half of this course from 7 to 12, but I want to introduce it in a general overview now. And that error is the mind-body dichotomy. The mind-body dichotomy. In my opinion, this is actually the most important issue in philosophy. I don't know whether I'll stand by that in 5 years, but at the moment, it is certainly the most important issue in philosophy that I can see, and it's the real killer of good people. The thing that wrecks their mental processes. Now, you know, of course, from lectures and books, in general, what this is about, and I'm not going to rehash it in much detail. This is the idea that there's a basic dichotomy running through human life, affecting every vital area. Everything, in effect, is divisible into the mind or the soul versus the body, the spiritual versus the material or the physical, with the idea you have to choose one or the other. Now, there's all sorts of variants. I think I once made a list of 28 different variants, which I'm just going to rattle off a few. Don't copy them down because I'm going to talk too fast. It's just to give you an idea of the tremendous scope of this. Theory versus practice. Love versus sex. The moral versus the practical. Pure science versus applied science. Reason versus emotions. Art versus business. Concepts versus percepts. Rationalism versus empiricism, the analytic versus the synthetic, happiness versus pleasure, art versus entertainment, etc., etc., etc. Actually, my next book is going to be on this issue. I intend to cover this from beginning to end in all its variants. Now, I don't want to imply that any of these variants are unimportant. Each of them is somewhat different from the next. But in my view, three of them stand out above all the rest. All the others are forms or derivatives. But there are three that I would single out as the real heart of this dichotomy of the mind versus the body. Remember, I'm considering it as it applies to good people, to objectivists. And I'm going to give you a moment. Well, there can be good non-objectivists too, but I'm here focusing on how it would be a problem to objectives. I'll give you a moment. If you had to pick out three, what would be the three variants of this dichotomy you would pick out? I'll give you about 15 seconds to jot them down. This is a kind of subjective exercise because it depends on your purpose. And these are the three most important for my purposes. Let me tell you the three that I pick out as most essential, and then I'll say something about them. The moral versus the practical. Reason versus emotion. Concepts versus percepts. How many got those three? Well, then this is an original point. I don't see one hand. Well, let me elaborate those three. Now, you, of course, already know these dichotomies, so I'm not going to lecture on them tonight. I want to put each of them to you from the one perspective, and I want you to see if you can see a common denominator uniting all three. Obviously, something beyond the fact that they are instances of the mind-body dichotomy, that we know to begin with. I want something beyond that. Now, I want to give you the three in condensed form, and you tell me, if you can, what is common to all three of these dichotomies? The moral versus the practical. Well, that is basically the following problem. How to do right and succeed in the world as it actually is. How to do right and succeed in the world as it actually is. The moral versus the practical is a problem of action. It's a problem of what to do. And as it stands in the mind of the person, there's a conflict. He feels, I have my own standards in my own mind, but I'm confronted by an alien world that does not necessarily adapt to my standards. So that if I act on my standards, he feels, I'm going to be led to destruction or failure in the actual world. What should I do? That is the problem of the moral versus the practical as it stands in the minds of good people. Reason versus emotion. And there the problem is how to follow reason while feeling. This is basically a problem not of action, but of emotion or feeling. And here the conflict in the person's mind is like this. I want to follow reason. I want to be true to my own intellectual conclusions, but I'm confronted by alien, non-rational thrusts. From what? Well, he might say from his body, or if he's an objectivist, he'll say from his subconscious. But it doesn't make any difference because his subconscious in his mind at this moment amounts to his body, his brain, his automatized mechanism. Something outside of his conscious mind now. He feels, I've got these feelings. Some of them don't conform to my thoughts. I want to follow reason, but I'm confronted by these alien thrusts. The emotions, some of them at least. What to do about them? Now look at the third, concepts versus percepts. Now, this is basically a problem, not of action or feeling, but thinking. How to think correctly. How to use your mind. And here the person has a conflict as follows. He wants to use concepts. He wants to think abstractly. He wants to connect ideas by the use of logic. But he finds himself confronted by sense data, facts, observations from reality, which simply do not adhere to his conclusions, which contradict them, even though his reasoning in his own mind seems impeccable to him. Now, of course, you know the name of the type of person in philosophy that clings to concepts and says, in effect, Facts may contradict my concepts, but if so, it's tough on the facts. What is that called philosophically? A rationalist. And it's dominated philosophy through the ages, at least the better philosophy. Starting way back with Parmenides, who gave an argument as to why change is impossible, and then he saw things change in front of his eyes, and he says they're not really changing, because that simply does not adhere to my unanswerable argument. Now, what is the common denominator in all these three cases? The moral versus the practical, reason versus emotion, concepts versus percepts. What is common, beside the fact that they're all variants of the mind-body dichotomy? I'm just afraid to ask you, because you give me the wrong answer, you're going to derail me altogether. The crow epistemology will set in, and they'll lose everything. All right, try. What do you say? No. That's why I'd rather do it myself. He said life versus philosophy, and in a way, but that's not the point that I'm after. You want to try? Yes.
I think that people are willing to be inconsistent, and they refuse to make everything consistent. They won't work on it.
That is not my point either. Let me tell you my point, and then you can tell me yours afterwards. I would say in all three cases, it seems to the person that there is a conflict between the internal and the external, between the inner world and the outer. It's your own standards versus the uncontrolled world of other people. So therefore, you can't be sure that your own standards will lead to success. Or it's your standards versus uncontrolled responses thrust on you. Or your standards, your inner proper method versus uncontrolled facts that leap out at you and smash your standard. So it seems to people as though the alternative is have your own standards, remain in inner control of your life by means of cutting off, minimizing, turning away from the external, or give in to the external, conform to it, and therefore abandon your own inner integrity and standards. That would mean have moral standards, give up the quest for practicality. Have rational self-supervision, give up feeling. Have logic and conceptual system in your thought, forget about facts. Or take the other side. Deal with practical situations, feelings, facts as they come up, but do it without method, standards, or your own inner control. Now you see, this is a terrible dilemma. If you have any part of it, a really terrible dilemma. And unfortunately, most people cannot put it together. Now we could summarize the results of people's choices as follows. Make a chart if you're taking notes. Top of one side, one column, write mind or soul, I don't care what you call it. On the other, write body. And then there would be three columns going across. Action, feeling, thought. So you're going to have a little, six boxes. Mind, and then under it, what action, feeling, thought, and the other side, body, etc. And this is the terms I would give to summarize the choices that people make if they feel they must make this dichotomy. On the mind side, under action, if the person chooses, in other words, morality, chooses principles, ideals, he will come out, let us say, a tortured idealist. Put that down. There's no one word that I can find in this case for an idealist who's tortured. So we have to use two words. On the other hand, the body side, there is a word for. If you make the choice of practicality over morality, What are you? There's a special name in philosophy for that. A pragmatist, right. That's what a pragmatist is. Now under feeling, if you choose the mind side, in other words, you say, I'm going to remain in control. I'm not having any truck with these things that are thrust on me that I can't control. What is a good name for the feeling division under the mind side? A repressor. And that's either ER or OR, according to your choice. The repressor. And if you choose the body side, you say to hell with logic and standards, I have feelings and I'm going to act on them, and that's it. Well, you could call it a hedonist, but there's a better name, because a hedonist is just for pleasure. But we're taking in general emotions of any kind as a primary here. Call it an emotionalist, that's the best name, right. An emotionalist. Now on the thought side, if you're on the mind side, and you cling to concepts at the price of facts, that we've already said, that is a rationalist. And there is the opposite in philosophy too, under the body side. If you cling to facts and are scornful of concepts, who knows what that's called? Empiricist, E-M-P-I-R, peer, I-C-I-S-T, empiricist. Now you can tell these types, I think. You can see them all over the place. Now, of these three dichotomies, all forms of the inner versus the outer, the one I regard as the most basic, which one would you think I regard as the most basic? Well, I think thought is more basic than feeling or action. So I think that the real dichotomy here is rationalism versus empiricism. The others, to some extent, take care of themselves if we grasp that issue. Now, if you think that you have any part of this problem on either side of the dichotomy, in any one of these divisions, the chances are very strong that you succumb to rationalism or empiricism in some way. If I've learned anything about people or philosophy in my years, it's how fantastically widespread this dichotomy of rationalism versus empiricism is. It is much more than merely applicable to technical philosophers. It's very, very common among objectivists. Now, objectivists tend, for obvious reasons, to which side of this dichotomy? The mind or the body side? The mind side. They're staunch idealists, repressors, and rationalists if they're going to go for this dichotomy at all. There is an exception. There's a certain type who's on the other side. Now, if I hesitate, I really hesitate. I'm actually terrified to make this point because of the storm that will descend upon me. But for what it's worth, with tremendous qualifications and reservations, this is not a universal truth, simply a tendency. I have noticed a more pronounced inclination of objectivist males to go for rationalism and females for empiricism. Now, obviously, this is not a sexual phenomenon. I have known rationalist women and also women who are okay, who don't have either of these. And I've known empiricist men, so this is not a guarantee, but there's a certain reason. You might even guess it because you see that rationalism is connected to repression. And you know that there's a sort of a culturally different expectation for women and men with regard to emotions. So you could have a clue already that there might be a little difference in many women versus many men. That may help you if you know your own sex to guess in which direction the lectures will be of most use to you. But maybe you don't fit into the stereotype. Now, I want to just conclude by tying these mind-body issues into the anti-philosophical arguments that we started with. I swear it's a complete coincidence. I first lectured long ago on the three main forms. I was saying that I lectured a long time ago on the three main forms of the mind-body dichotomy. And then only in preparation for this course did I figure out the three arguments. And only after I wrote them did I realize there's a one-to-one correlation between these three main dichotomies and the three main arguments as follows. Take the uselessness of philosophy in daily life, that argument. That implies, it rests on the idea of a disconnection between abstractions and concretes. It implies that abstractions are irrelevant to the reality that you live with and deal with. In other words, it's the idea that philosophy is useless. The idea of philosophy as a system of ideas without connection to daily life comes from rationalism. And this, I may say, is one reason why students have so much trouble digesting objectivism. They try honestly to understand it, but they have unwittingly, subconsciously absorbed a rationalist idea of thought. And that controls implicitly the function of their mind. It defines, without their even knowing it, what constitutes understanding, logic, order, etc. It warps their whole approach to philosophy, unknown to themselves. And so they struggle and struggle, and they can't see why they never get the clarity thereafter. And you see, rationalism thereby becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Not knowing that they hold it, their ideas remain disconnected. However, they struggle, and they end up feeling philosophy is useless. Now, take philosophy versus the self, that argument. That really comes down to philosophy versus your inner feelings or desires. In other words, your conclusions of your mind versus your emotions. So if a person feels that philosophy squelches the self, that means the choice as he sees it is philosophy versus the self, your thought versus your feelings, reason versus emotions. And now if you are on the rationalist or mind side of the dichotomy, then of course you will be especially prone to repression when you're confronted with this dichotomy. And that will give color and plausibility to the idea that you have to choose. It's yourself or your philosophy. And the issue of philosophy versus the world, well, that's obviously your own standards versus getting along with others. Your view of right and wrong versus what works when dealing with other people. In other words, it comes down to the moral versus the practical. And again, if as an objectivist you're shunted onto the moralist or idealist side of this dichotomy, you end up feeling malevolent and gloomy about your chances in the world. In other words, all of the issues we started with tonight are forms of the mind-body dichotomy and couldn't exist without it. And I think that's what basically predisposes people to them. People come to objectivism, committed without knowing it to the mind-body dichotomy in all kinds of unidentified forms. They accept objectivism sincerely, but they do so, in effect, through a filter, through the filter of this mind-body issue. Deep down, they still accept, above all, the dichotomy of ideas versus reality. They still hold ideas in a rationalistic form, even without knowing it. And the result is they end up as malevolent repressors. Or they can't take that state, and they then rebel and say, to hell with philosophy. They jump to the other side and become emotionalist and pragmatist, which is just the other side of the same dichotomy, the body side of the issue. So to summarize, there are two things I would say that enter into creating a disillusioned philosopher. One is lacking knowledge of the method. His ideas are unchewed, therefore dissociated from reality. And the second is, instead of grasping that this is wrong and correcting the deficiency, the mind-body dichotomy takes over and makes him feel such is life. This is the way philosophy has to be. So the only solution is to regain contact with the actual by dropping philosophy. Well, what is the answer to this twofold problem? Two answers. First, learn the right method. And then get rid of the mind-body dichotomy, especially its three leading forms. If you can do that, the result will be to reestablish your own thought on a reality basis and thereby establish harmony between your thought and yourself or emotions, and a harmony in principle between yourself and the outer world. It is not necessary for an objectivist to feel that his self is being throttled. It is not necessary to feel that the world, even today's world, is hopeless. These are errors. They're caused in part by lack of method and in part by an insidious mind-body dichotomy. And the purpose of this course is this twofold attack, one half to one, one half to the other. Now, I want to stress that I regard the whole problem as honest so far as we will deal with it here. It is not evil or immoral as such. Rationalism is not an issue of moral default. I insist on that because I wrestled with that problem for many years in a tremendously acute form. Many very virtuous people do it, often out of conscientiousness. We are left in the dark with no idea of how to deal with ideas. And we end up automatizing wrong ways of dealing with ideas. We end up in a position of despair, in effect. We can't live with philosophy or without it. And that's exactly what we want to deal with head on in this course, starting next week. Thank you. We'll take about a 3-minute break if you have to leave, and then we'll have questions. Now, before we turn to questions, I have one thing that I want to say, and that is homework for the entire class for next time if you want to do homework. This is not mandatory, but if you do it, you might get farther ahead from the course. Next time, the general topic, the philosophic idea that we're going to cover, is life as the standard of value. I'm starting there because it's not as complicated as some of the other issues. For instance, out of metaphysics and epistemology. And yet it is abstract enough to give us a good first example. Now, our concern in this course is with the method. I'm not lecturing, of course, on life as the standard of value. Although we want to end up having that really clear. But above all, we want to get principles from it as to how to get anything clear. We're only going to get to do 4 or 5 ideas in the whole first half of the course. And I've tried to choose significant, typical issues which raise different kinds of problems. Now, your homework simply amounts to this. Refresh your recollection of what objectivism says about this topic. Either lecture notes, or take a quick look at Galt's speech, or the objectivist ethics, or whatever. Prepare in your own mind what your understanding is. You're not going to be asked, because I have a stage demonstration for next time. Deliberately warped step at a time, in order to bring out various points. But if you have something worked out, that you can compare your own mental process to, it'll be that much more instructive to you. You should not spend more than, I would say, an hour and a half on this. Maybe 30, 40 minutes to skim the stuff that you've presumably already read a dozen times. And then put it all away and say to yourself, what do I really understand on the question, how can I validate, prove life as the standard of value? And just jot down extemporaneously a few little points that would amount to, this is what I understand. And we'll then, from there, you'll have some way to judge yourself as against the demonstration that I'll give you next time. Okay, now we can turn to questions. Now, do you want to stand and bellow?
There's a term that was used in the earlier lecture called objectivitis. Is this what you were referring to?
I never heard the term objectivitis. I didn't use that.
Well, I have heard it used in discussing objectivism, among other...
I wouldn't want to comment on the term. The term seems to me inappropriate because the suffix itis means inflammation. And I don't think it's helpful to describe it as inflammation of your objectivism. So I would much rather describe the problem as rationalism, which is a really technical term which names the real problem. And the rest is just a superficial way of saying they don't like objectivism, so it doesn't really help. That's what I would call an emotive or pejorative term rather than a factual description. Yes, Lau.
When you asked about the common denominator of the three dichotomies, I wanted to answer the same way this gentleman has answered, that is, philosophy versus life. You came back with an answer, internal versus external.
Right.
I do not understand the difference between the two.
Well, the difference is very simply this. Philosophy versus life is merely a specification, a concrete form of the internal versus the external. As I was using, and this is a very, very broad dichotomy in order to encompass all of these sub-dichotomies. It's the inner world versus the outer, and the inner world may not necessarily take the form of philosophy. It takes the form of thought of some kind, but now whether it's philosophy or scientific thought or thought about some problem or thought about your psychology, that yet is not yet specified, you see. Now, if a person experiences the dichotomy of his life versus philosophy, he certainly has fallen for this dichotomy. But that is one specific form. And as I tried to argue, that really comes from all of the different dichotomies because of a warped view of philosophy, which comes from a warped view of the relation of concepts to percepts. See? So I wanted a very abstract statement because I think it's very important to realize that the hardest thing for people in this regard is to have a harmony between the inside and the outside. Then all the rest is the ways, the causes of this problem and the ways to overcome it, the forms of it. But the abstract essence is that. And that's what I want to focus on to unite them. Now I'll try over here. Well, I can't see. You'll have to wave your hand. Yes.
Harmony inside and outside. Now, you pay good money to rent this room.
And certainly did.
And the equipment has broken down several times tonight. How do you resolve that in reference to the ideal and the real?
Well, when I rent a room, if you want that concrete discussed, having lectured in New York for a long time, I'm very pleased about two things. That there were chairs and lights. From there, it's all gravy. Now, realistically, we'll discuss it with the management, but this does not make me feel that it's hopeless. As a matter of fact, the management of this hotel was very, very pleasant. They really did try. We had an assistant here up to about 15 minutes before the lecture, and he kept being baffled by the fact that the sound broke. So, I mean, I put it down to people are not omniscient, and I don't draw conclusions that it's hopeless. I have a written question, but the trouble is if it's this long a written question, I'll have to take it home because I can't take the time to read it. So if you want written questions answered, see, this one is also very long. What aspect did you present to the world, and more particularly in your lectures, when you experienced the mind-body dichotomy? Did you voice doubt about your understanding of objectivism to Miss Rand, and more importantly, to your audience? And if not, why not? Good question. Yes, I certainly did to Miss Rand. I many, many, many times told her, I do not understand this point. This topic is not clear to me. And we went over it from many different aspects, and there was a long period of time where I did not lecture. precisely because I did not know clearly what I was talking about. And there was a transition period where I was lecturing. I was, the compromise or the resolution I reached in my own mind was this: I tried to lecture only on something that was reasonably clear to me. I did not go into the parts I didn't understand. I didn't say things that I thought were unclear and put one over on the audience. I restricted what I said to what I did understand. And my understanding is that if you have limited knowledge, you do not have to be omniscient. People can get value of what you do present, and it is not necessary to announce all the things you do not understand if they do not impinge upon what you do within a context. Now, the full answer to this question would amount to my giving you the spiral theory of knowledge, which I believe we're going to cover in Lecture 3. But the fact is, I will understand objectivism better in 10 years than now, and the same exact argument could be used. There are things which I may think I'm clear about now which will be much more tied to reality in 10 years, because the essence of knowledge is to go over and over the same things and get better and better. So by the logic of the implication of the question, if you wait till you really have it, you'd have to wait till the death sentence is pronounced and then race up to the lecture platform and spill it out and die. So that's why I didn't do it that way. Now, in what form was it available? You can hear in some of those early lectures definite signs of rationalism. There is no doubt about that. There are topics that I would never put the same way now, although at that time I thought it was completely clear and absolutely convincing. And in fact, if you've taken all my courses, you know that in certain courses I say officially, this now supersedes what I said in course X, which was confused, although I didn't know it at the time. Once you become familiar with rationalism, you can definitely hear it in some of the things. Now, thanks to Ms. Ran, a lot of that would have come out as rationalism, she caught in advance when I discussed the lecture with her. And that was a very lucky thing for all people concerned. But this is definitely the case. I hope that it didn't come out too blatantly, but it is there to be perceived if you want to perceive it. That doesn't mean I think that the lectures are wrong in essence, but there are ways in which they're sometimes misleading because I was rationalist without knowing. Yes, sir. Lau.
There's a problem that's been disturbing me for many years, ever since I began the study of objectivism, and that concerns the issue that knowledge is essentially contextual, and that one should not need a great deal of specialized knowledge, nor be particularly highly educated in order to be able to think about philosophical terms and to integrate them into one's life. This, in particular, usually takes the form of an example of a truck driver, for example. Let's say who wasn't particularly highly educated, but nevertheless was thoughtful about the knowledge that he did possess, should be able. Is it true, let me ask this question, is it true that objectivism holds that this individual should be able to integrate objectivism into his life? And how does that answer, jive with the question, the issue that you seem to have raised tonight of the difficulty, especially the intellectual difficulty, even grasping the methodology? Yeah.
That's a very good question. The answer I would give is this: it is still true that to digest the philosophy, you have to go through a complex method, and that a truck driver cannot do it. He can do it, but he'd have to do it. The fact of just getting a few generalities is not sufficient. So it comes down to this: what does the truck driver get out of a certain type of philosophy? And that depends what kind of world does he live in and what kind of action does he engage in. I would say this: if you lived in an objectivist world, and you were bombarded with objectivist ideas all the time, you know, the way today you're bombarded with anti-objectivist ideas, and you absorb them through your pores, it would not be the kind of work that it is now, where you're going against the mainstream, where you have to digest a tremendous amount that's alien to everything you hear and the way you were brought up. Now, a truck driver in Atlantis, let us say, who was born and brought up there, would not, I don't think, have to go through that complex a process. Particularly if he was, you know, honest, his actions were commensurate with the scale of his understanding, he would have a generalized understanding, that would be fine. That is not applicable today. I would venture to say that there is the following phenomenon, this I admit, there is such a thing as like an honest truck driver even today, who would read the novels, say this is true, and up to a point, accept them and live by them, up to a point, but that is very unusual. It's a very rare phenomenon, and it depends how much pressure the person can take, you know, from things that he can't explain, outside or inside, before he starts to succumb, and gradually the thing atrophies in his mind. So I would have to say my considered answer would be this. In today's world, without this process of digestion, it is very hard, it is impossible, really, to keep objectivism real in its full ramifications. I really don't think it can be done. I leave open some exceptional psychology that is much more exceptional than mine, that is untouched in effect by what goes on, that can just grasp certain essentials and live by them. I mean, I can't prove that can't exist, but I've never seen it. And consequently, within the framework of what I've seen, without this process, people struggle, they agonize, and they fall. Yes? Well, I was just going to add, this process is not a total mystery, so sometimes people get a certain variant of it on their own, within their own context, so it's not as though this course is, you know, the key to the universe. Yes?
I'm not quite sure I'm with this point on the truck driver, so let me maybe ask the same question in a different way. Are you saying that a truck driver or a person with a limited IQ, to use that term, cannot, one, learn to digest or chew fully?
No. I certainly am not saying that. Let me correct that right away. First of all, I do not equate a truck driver with limited IQ. So take that out. A truck driver is a professional issue of what he's doing with his life, not his mental capacity. Now, if you have a limited IQ, obviously you are going to have trouble in philosophy of any kind. That certainly goes without saying, because philosophy is tremendously abstract. But by the same token, if you have a limited IQ, the problems that can come up are limited intellectually. So you're protected by the fact that if you're honest, you only deal in very simple issues. So you'll never get to the stage of feeling of problems on the level of sophistication we're talking about. Am I saying a truck driver or someone who is very non-intellectual by profession can't grasp philosophy? Certainly not. There are all kinds of degrees of what you can do to grasp philosophy, from a general understanding, which is of general value, only that's all, on up to a very concretized, reality-oriented understanding, which gives you really that truck-like perception across the board and arms you in a tremendous number of situations. There is an issue of degrees. It is not the case that either everything floats or you've hit the jackpot philosophically. In fact, most people are somewhere in between. So let's add that into the pot to clarify. Yes, I see five fingers over there. Yes.
I purchased the tape of Ayn Rand's last lecture, an economic lecture. And she said, someone asked her a question, what events shaped your life? And she said, that's a good question, because my philosophy was shaped by observation, not events. And I thought about that a long time, and I looked on the street, and I realized that most people don't confront the world they live in. I see people walk down New York City, and they see bums on the street, and they can't look at it. It's too evil to confront or something. Or they hear about Nazi Germany, and they just, right away, they just can't confront the whole idea. And I realized that Ayn Rand grew up in Russia during the time of the Russian Revolution, and what she had to confront, it struck me, was obviously a lot of evil that she was in the midst of, and she took it head on. And it occurred to me that the fundamental problem with you know, integrating it to life. Objectivism is the ability to not shirk away from life, but to confront it.
Well, I agree and disagree with your statement. It's correct that she made the point that it wasn't the events that shaped her, but her observations. Her observations, obviously, of the reality around her. And that ties into what we've been saying tonight about deriving philosophy from reality. I do not agree with you, however, that the essential thing in this context is the confrontation with evil. Obviously, if you're a Pollyanna and you deny the existence, or you're excessively squeamish and you just evade it or look away, to that extent, your understanding is impaired. You have to confront whatever you deal with and is around you. But I would not give primacy to the perception of evil. In fact, to get philosophy, before you even get to good or evil, you have to get to facts. You have to confront what is, I mean, about metaphysical reality. And then you have value judgments. And I think in Ayn Rand's case, she herself would have said that if she had to single out something in the value realm that had the greatest importance to her in shaping her, that something that she observed or encountered, it wouldn't be the communists, but Victor Hugo, which had a much greater influence on her, you know, than the communists, although obviously she grew up in the shadow of the communists, and that was not insignificant. So I wouldn't make it as malevolent an orientation as your question implies. I don't think the essence is confronting the naked evil, but, of course, that is one aspect. Let me take a quick look. This is short. I do not know of any literature that I would approve of on that question, so if you asked a question on literature, that was the answer. I can't read the writing here. I'll have to try to decipher this. If you want me to read it at the time, you have to write it sort of legibly, because if it's a big scrawl, I can't do it. I'd like to take one more. Somebody near the back, is there? Yes.
Comment on the moral versus the practical, you implied that someone who was applying objectivism the right way in his own life wouldn't constantly get lost in the world or even in today's world.
Correct.
Yet in many of Ayn Rand's lectures on collectivist societies, or even through observation growing up in certain types of families or with certain types of schooling, it seems almost impossible that somebody who was an objectivist and applying it correctly could survive. At what point would you say the environment or the society in which one lives makes it impossible for a rational person to survive?
Well, that's a good question, but it's really pertains to what we're going to be covering much later. But just to answer you factually, as you state right now, you couldn't survive in a dictatorship. You couldn't survive in a totalitarian country. But so long as you're in the United States or Canada, you're in a relatively free country, if you can't survive, you can't blame it on the system around you. Now, I would add this. There is a certain type of environment that a child could grow up in that is so tremendously irrational that he's crippled for life, even in the United States. That certainly exists. I don't think it's as common as some people think, but it's certainly not negligible. There are people who are really maimed, and that is a problem that no philosophy that I know of is going to solve, because they're hurt so deeply, so profoundly before they've got off the ground, so to speak, that it's a question of how they can ever reconstruct themselves. But let me just finish this. I can't say at what point. I mean, I can't say it happens by this age, because it depends from person to person. I can't say it depends on this particular problem or parent, because they may be from another one. That would be a whole separate talk in itself, which would require a great deal of knowledge of psychology, which I do not have. All I can say, and what I was saying, is this much. If you live in a relatively free country, and you were not made psychotic by your parents, so that whatever your problems, you can perceive, you can grasp, you can talk to people, you don't have this incredible desire to fling yourself over the Empire State Building and fly to Venus, etc. On those terms, if you have that much, then I say, sure, you could have a lot of problems with other people. I do, everybody does. You could have a lot of frustrations with the world as it is. No philosophy is going to make it all go away and make it all wonderful. But what I'm saying is, If you have those two minimum prerequisites for a free country and a basic sanity, you should be able to live your life as an objectivist without the feeling of malevolence, gloom, and doom, without the feeling that it's impossible, that I can't survive, that life is against me, that I'm a loner and I'm lost. Now, how to do that without pretending that everything is really terrific? That's the whole point of how to reconcile philosophy with life. And that's the point of what is your philosophy? What does it really say? And that's what we're going to be discussing. All right. We will close at this point. Thank you very much. And continue a week from tonight.